Welcome to the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. I'm your host, Chase Maxwell. Twenty-one years ago, the Friends began a storytelling series for adults. What could be better than sitting by the fire, sipping a warm cup of coffee or cider, while listening to some of the best writers Minnesota has to offer? Over the years, the Fireside series has featured a great range of authors, from Katie Camillo to Jack Weatherford, Carol Bly to Jack Elhai, making the winter just that much more bearable. The 2015 lineup is no exception. Well, there actually is one exception, and you're listening to it. For over 20 years, the Fireside series has drawn enthusiastic crowds to the beautiful, but small, Hamlin Midway Library. And this is one way we're celebrating that legacy, by broadcasting the entire season and reaching a larger audience. Episode 2 features William Swanson discussing his new book, Stolen from the Garden, the thrilling true crime story of the 1972 abduction of Virginia Piper, one of the largest kidnap for ransom cases in the history of the FBI. Drawing on government documents and exclusive interviews with family members, the book provides the first comprehensive account of the sensational kidnapping and its long, eventful aftermath. Swanson is also the author of Dial M, The Murder of Carol Thompson, and Black, White, Blue, The Assassination of Patrolman Sackett. Please note that this episode has some disturbing content related to the real events Swanson investigates in his books. With that warning out of the way, sit back, cider in hand, and get ready to be transported.
There really is a fire. I thought fireside, you know, that's cute. But there really is a fire, and so I don't need the jacket. I have mixed feelings about libraries, public libraries. On the one hand, I'm standing here tonight in large part because of the Roosevelt Branch Library in South Minneapolis, where I grew up. One of my earliest and fondest memories is as my one or both of my older sisters dragging me up to the library several times a week and coming back with arms load of books that really instilled in me the love of reading. And if you want to write, you got to read. So the reading, is, in my case, certainly did lead to the writings. On the other hand, people will say to me, "Oh, Bill, I loved your latest book. I got it from the library," and I'm thinking, you know, they are for sale. You know, this is a profit-making venture, at least it's supposed to be. I'm assuming that, judging by hair color, et cetera, that many of you are familiar with the Virginia Piper kidnapping case. Dark-haired people are shaking their heads. So I'm just gonna assume that all of you at least need a primer as to the case, and then I'll give you a brief overview. It's a very complicated case that in practical sense is still open. It is a whodunit that has really never been solved. If you don't believe the FBI, they consider it a closed case, but virtually nobody else does. But it's a case that was in the headlines virtually every day beginning in June or July of 1972. And through a couple of controversial trials in federal court in St. Paul in 1977 and 1979. And as I say, because of the fact that nobody has spent a day in prison for this crime, and except for about $4,000 in stray $20 bills, that $1 million ransom that Harry Piper paid for his wife's release has never been recovered. So it's still an ongoing case. It's still a big deal. The headlines are not as frequent as they used to be, but those of us of a certain age will certainly recall that summer afternoon when two masked men, each waving two guns, walked through the front door of Harry and Virginia Piper's home in suburban Orono on the other side of Lake Minnetonka, and walked out with Virginia Piper. They put a pillowcase over her head, threw her in the back seat of their car, and drove off, parts unknown. Before they left, they deposited an envelope with an intricately designed and developed ransom note demanding $1 million in $20 bills. That's 50,000 $20 bills. Well, as it happened, they drove north and eventually ended up in Jay Cook State Park, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, just south of Duluth. Virginia Piper was taken up into the woods and held there for 2 days, as it happened. In the evening, she was chained to a tree. She had one captor watching over her during this time. Meantime, Harry Piper, following the instructions, the ransom instructions, and then a series of intricate, almost reverse scavenger hunt type instructions, delivered the $1 million in $20 bills. He had a big duffel bag in the trunk of his car, weighed 110 and a half pounds. That's what $1 million weighs, in case you're interested. And he delivered it and ended up in a parking lot in a seedy bar in the shadow of downtown Minneapolis. There, presumably, the money was transferred from the trunk of the car he was driving to the kidnapper's car while he was inside, again following their instructions, trying to make a phone call. Virginia Piper was rescued from her hiding place, such as it was, in Jay Cook Park on Saturday about noon. She was kidnapped on Thursday. He delivered the money on Friday, and she was rescued following an anonymous call to a Minneapolis clergyman on Saturday morning. This unidentified male provided instructions that the clergyman was told to pass on to the FBI, which he did. She was rescued and brought home and reunited with her family Saturday afternoon. Incredibly, while she was exhausted and wet, it had been raining up in that part of the state, and hungry, she hadn't eaten much, and highly traumatized, as you'd expect, she was unharmed. She was not sexually molested or even threatened, for that matter. But needless to say, her world was turned upside down, her world and her family's world, and indeed the community's world, after this case. Well, the FBI was on the case immediately, I mean literally within an hour of the abduction. And over the course of the next 5 years, the FBI, through its headquarters in Minneapolis, would devote tens of millions of dollars to this case, literally hundreds of agents at various times, and more than 1,000 persons of interest. 16 days before the expiration of the statute of limitations for kidnapping, for federal kidnapping, two men were arrested in Minneapolis, two small-time career criminals named Kenneth Callahan and Donald Larson. We can talk about why they were arrested. It's still controversial. But they were arrested and charged and indicted. And in the fall of 1977, ably defended by Ron Meshbesher and Bruce Hartigan, other additional names you'd recognize, they were tried in St. Paul and convicted of kidnapping Virginia Piper. That conviction was immediately appealed and overturned in federal appellate court. They were tried again in the fall of 1979, and this time, after a different jury, deliberated for only 3 hours. The first one had deliberated for 4 days. This one deliberated for 3 hours and acquitted them. Donald Larson, in one of the very odd twists in this case, was already in prison for life because in 1976, he had murdered 5 people, including his estranged wife, one of his children, and 3 additional children. Another bizarre side story in a saga that's full of bizarre side stories. So Donald Larson was already in prison, but Ken Callahan went free. So while Larson spent the rest of his life in prison, he did not spend a day for the Piper kidnapping. The family, meantime, went on with their lives. Harry Piper Jr., Virginia Piper's husband, was the chairman and CEO of Piper Jaffray and Hopwood, downtown Minneapolis, the well-known regional stock brokerage. They had three sons. Harry III was a lawyer. Addison, better known as Tad, the middle son, succeeded his father at Piper Jaffray when his father retired. And the third son, David, also became a lawyer and eventually a district court judge in Minneapolis, which post he holds to this day. Stories have appeared at various times. There have been rumors of various people connected with this crime. There have been rumors about where the money might have ended up, but none of these have proved conclusive. It is still very much a whodunit after all of these years. I got involved as a not-so-young journalist, younger than now, certainly. In 1972, I was working at UPI in Minneapolis, United Press International. And although I didn't actively report on the case, others in the Bureau did, I was involved in disseminating the information. And of course, if you lived in Minneapolis in 1972, and if you were in the news business, whoa, especially, this was the story of the summer, the local story for sure. It was a very busy news year, but this was at the top of the list, at least in this part of the country. It was kind of in the back of my mind as I wrote other books. But then in the winter of 2011-2012, thinking there might be a magazine story in this as we approach the 40th anniversary of the kidnapping, I contacted Harry Piper III, who was then living in Oregon. Harry, I had known some years earlier, had tried to write his own book on this case. He wanted to celebrate the bravery and the character of his parents. If you read the book, I think you'll come to the conclusion that they were indeed brave people and performed above and beyond the call of duty under severe pressures. And he also wanted to solve the case. As I say, he was a lawyer. In fact, for a while, he even worked for the Justice Department in Washington. But it was just, he went to court, he filed a Freedom of Information Act petition, and eventually, after spending $80,000 of his own money, ended up with about 80,000 pages of documents, FBI investigative documents, much of which are heavily redacted. I should remember at these events to bring some copies along, because you don't know whether to laugh or cry when you see these documents that are supposed to be enlightening, and three quarters of the lines are blacked out for no good reason, apparently. But he got all of that, and he got photographs from the FBI, and there were court documents from the first trial, and he got all of these. And he interviewed both Callahan and Larson, as well as a number of other people involved in the case. Callahan and Larson have since died, as have his parents. But he had all this information, and he gave up on it. He says, "I'm a lawyer, I'm not a writer." And he said, "Would you be interested?" He had read my first book and thought I treated the Thompson family with respect and accuracy. So I said, "Yeah, I would." And he talked to his brothers, and they agreed. And I ended up with access to all of these documents and these interviews that form the basis of this book. I then went out and did my own research, my own interviews, and that brought us to where we are tonight. Incidentally, there was no. The only stipulation that Harry required was that when I was done with my book, I would turn it all over to the Minnesota Historical Society Press, which I will happily do. And my wife will be even happier when I do that and free up our third bedroom. But it's an amazing case. A case raising far more questions than there are answers, at least at this point. And in my book, I spend about a third talking about the crime itself. and the ordeal of both Pipers, Ginny in the woods and Harry frantically trying to win her release. Also the investigation that the FBI launched and the response of the rest of the family and the community. The second part deals with the eventual arrests of Callahan and Larson. There are two long, as I say, controversial trials, an ultimate conviction and then acquittal. And the third section is what happens afterward. If you've read my previous books, you will know that I'm very interested in the long arc of these serious crimes. We all know about the crime immediately after it happens. We read about it daily for a few days or maybe a few weeks. And then it's gone. It's supplanted by a more recent horror. I've always been curious about what happens to the other victims, the living victims, who survive these cases and yet go to their graves eventually under the shadow that that these crimes cast over their lives. So I deal fairly heavily as well, in addition to the crime itself and the investigation, with the impact on the Piper family, an extraordinary family. So I'm going to read, I try to choose things that I'm interested in because I haven't read before. I hope you'll find this interesting. This kicks in December 1979, shortly after the acquittal and the end of the second trial. The Pipers are not the type to shake their fists and curse the heavens, throw crockery around the room, or vow vengeance against an enemy. The Pipers didn't have many enemies, for one thing. The word they use today and in the days that follow is disappointment. The trials are over. The two men Ginny and Bobby believed were guilty are free. At least one of them is, and the other one, the murderer, has been legally absolved to responsibility in the Piper case. They are relieved, of course, that the public scrutiny has been lifted. They will not have to stand in front of reporters and curiosity seekers and the two men who were responsible for this whole sordid experience and answer insinuating questions as though they were guilty of something. At the same time, there are all these roiling emotions that the word disappointment is intended to mask. The frustration, the anger, and yes, the disquieting knowledge that the awful men who upended their lives, or men with similar motives, are still out there. The fear, when thought about with a cool head, doesn't make much sense. The kidnappers have the money. They got away scot-free with the loot, and they can't be tried again for kidnapping. And yes, Larson is no longer a threat, but what about Callahan? The thought, irrational as it may be, is chilling. Ginny shared something unique with the man called Alabama. The man who was guarding her in the woods called himself Alabama. She believed, and the prosecution believed, that Alabama was in fact Ken Callahan. The two of them sat within a couple of feet of each other for the better part of 2 days and talked about their lives. Even if Alabama was making most of it up, surely some of what he told her was factual, or partly factual. Everything she told him, as best she can recall, was the truth. Everybody by this time has heard of the Stockholm Syndrome, the bond that supposedly can develop between captor and hostage. If asked, Ginny would never say there was a bond, emotional, psychological, or otherwise, between her and Alabama. But there was definitely an experience she has shared with no one else in her life. Ginny, moreover, is still convinced that there were at least three men involved. So suppose that third man was in fact an insider, someone working in Bobby's office or living in the neighborhood, or comparing golf scores at the Woodhill Bar. Someone knew more about the family than Callahan and Larson could possibly have known. More, as far as that goes, than could be observed or surmised from Spring Hill Road, even if that someone got a few things wrong. Suppose that the third man remains nearby. Suppose behind a duplicitous smile and phony bonhomie, he is watching the Piper kids and grandkids while they go off to work or swim at the club. With so many unanswered, perhaps unanswerable questions, can the Pipers truly feel safe? Jenny does not feel that the FBI or the prosecutor let them down. On the contrary, she speaks fondly of Pete Newman and Thor Anderson, two men who devoted most of the past 7 years to her case. And she has written them grateful letters telling them so. She can't imagine how they could have worked any harder on her behalf. No, it was the agonizingly slow and inefficient criminal justice process that failed them. The fact that so many men and taxpayer dollars were devoted to that effort made the system seem especially impotent. The trials were maddening. Jenny was pleased that Callahan and Larson had to testify during the second trial, though they said nothing new or informative. At least the two of them had to go through the same kind of public questioning that she and Bobby had, which only seemed fair. But she is still, in many ways, and may always be, frustrated that she hadn't been allowed to speak her mind on the stand. Despite patient explanations by her lawyer sons, she doesn't seem to fully appreciate the presumption of a defendant's innocence, not when she is convinced that that defendant is guilty. The Pipers' lives definitely changed after the kidnapping. But the question has always been, in what ways and to what extent were they going to let the experience dictate the terms of that change? Absolutely not, his parents said, practically in unison, when David suggested dropping out of college so he could stay nearby. Your life must go on. The couple discussed selling the house, a crime scene after all, but decided against it. They had lived there since 1952. Their boys had grown up in its sunny rooms. Jenny and Bobby loved the house and its flowered grounds and the view down the grassy slope to the lake. They had already made several adjustments, Bobby curtailing his travel, switching to an unlisted phone number, and canceling home deliveries, to name a few. They were not going to let the criminals take their house away from them. Of course, especially during the first several months, and then again in the months leading up to the indictments and trials, Thor and Pete and other agents were frequent visitors. That was reassuring, large, friendly men, some of whom carried guns under their jackets, but also a vivid reminder of what had happened to Jenny. As difficult as it was for her to venture out at first, the Pipers decided early on that Jenny would not relinquish her life in the community. She had chaired Northwestern Hospital's all-women board for 5 years, and by all accounts played an important role during the subsequent addition of male board members in Northwestern's merger with Abbott Hospital. Next to her family, her volunteer hospital work was the most important part of her life. She ran the board meetings with an intelligence and charm that even the hospital's mostly male administrators and staff physicians, with whom she sometimes locked horns, admired. She was intense, well-organized, and hands-on, never above pausing to straighten a stack of magazines in a waiting room or to commend a member of the custodial staff for a job well done. She was comfortable talking with everybody, from the hospital's lordly surgical staff to the ladies dishing out the mac and cheese in the cafeteria. For years, she hosted a gala lawn party for the hospital's nurses. Clicking down a corridor in high heels and a dress straight out of the window at Harold's, she was a sight and sound few of her colleagues would forget. She loved being at the hospital, and that is where she returned a few months after the kidnapping. But being out and about in her community offered new and unwelcome changes. Jenny had been turning heads since she was a teen, but now people were looking at her in a different way. She had become a public curiosity, an unwitting celebrity. Dark glasses and a scarf were no more effective a disguise for her in Minneapolis than they were for Grace Kelly in Hollywood. Minnesotans were famously reserved in those days, and they would pretend they weren't staring at her, but they stared. Otherwise approachable and happy to chat, she was treated differently, if in subtle ways, even in familiar and formerly comfortable settings. The Pipers had lost friends during the grueling investigation, some of whom felt they were suspected of involvement because of something the Pipers had told the FBI. Virtually everyone who had delivered something or done work at the house was checked out, planting, as Ginny's sister Carol put it, just that tiny seed of doubt as to whether Ginny trusted them. Some of the neighbors seemed to blame the Pipers for the notoriety the case brought down on their circle. Ginny would attend a gathering of church women, or someone would bring up the kidnapping, even though Ginny believed that everybody understood that the topic was no longer open for public discussion. When an acquaintance told her at a party sometime after the abduction that she looked tired and distraught, well, maybe not exactly in those words, she went home upset. She did not want to believe that the kidnapping had physically changed her. "I don't think I look any different," she would say to family members, who would never disagree. But she had changed. She was more inward-looking, more private and cautious. Friends insist that though they always felt welcome in the Piper house, Ginny was different, no less gracious than she had always been, but not as cheerful and outgoing either. She didn't seem to laugh as loud or as often as she once did. No one talked about the kidnapping when the Pipers had people over. Ginny was frightened and damaged, her niece Helen Morrison says now, but she would never show that outside the immediate family. These were women who put their faces on. There were other more insidious changes as well. Ginny had always enjoyed a drink. She and the housekeeper the family employed when the boys were little would routinely share cocktails when they had a few minutes to themselves. And she appreciated her martinis at the club and other social functions. After her abduction, she drank more often and more heavily, though now mainly at home. Her father was believed to have been an alcoholic, as were several other members of the Lewis and Piper clans, and so apparently was she. Tad, her second son, was, in his words, one of her drinking buddies. An admitted alcoholic himself, he would drop by the house on his way home from the office, and at the kitchen table or on the shaded terrace, the two of them would break out the doers. "Sometimes Dad was there and sometimes he was off doing his own thing," Tad, who's long since sober, recalls 40 years later. Ginny was talkative during their happy hours. Especially in the months immediately afterward, the kidnapping was often on her mind. She would become intense over her cocktails and cigarettes. The emotion wasn't fear at such times, so much as anger and impatience with the investigation. "Why can't they wrap this up?" she would say. "When are they going to arrest someone?" If Bobby joined them, conversation regarding the case was brief or non-existent. There was always the grandkids to talk about, or the business, or politics. Ginny and Bobby were rock-ribbed Nixon Republicans. Or Big Ten athletics. Though not an alumna, she was a diehard University of Minnesota football fan. When Bobby arrived, they found a way to talk around the 800-pound gorilla in the room. But the kidnapping experience festered in her, Tad recalls. She was the literal victim, after all. The fact that Dad had a business to run helped him put distance between the crime and his life. He was busy and didn't have the time to dwell on it the way Mom did. I spend a fair amount of time delving into Bobby Piper's character and experience as well, because this is a two-sided story, at least. Bobby's response to the kidnappers' demands, driving God knows where, with $1 million in the trunk of his car, not knowing if his wife was alive, not knowing if he was going to be alive at the end of the evening, really took a great deal of courage and fortitude on his part. So I give him a lot of attention in here too, but I wanted to kind of move things along here so I could hear what you were interested in talking about. Let me just pick up here a little bit about the two of them. I described the fact that, like many marriages, this one had its rough spots both before and after the abduction. And then I say, but whatever marital difficulties Ginny and Bobby experienced before the kidnapping, their relationship survived them and probably became stronger because of their shared ordeal. Ginny would sometimes joke about whether she had been worth $1 million, but she had to be profoundly affected by Bobby's mental strength and physical courage during the crisis. He personally and alone rode to her rescue, resolute and clear-headed despite his fear. If he ever described his solitary ride with all that money in his trunk and no idea who or what awaited him, or for that matter, whether either he or Ginny would survive the night, it may have been only to a confidant such as his close friend John Morrison. His sons, to whom he never said much about that night, considered him a hero, and Ginny did too. Their way of life would never be the same, but they would live forever after with the knowledge that he had been there when she needed him. Late in their lives, long after the terror and disappointment of the kidnapping and trials had receded, Ginny, who had 1,000 friends, tells David that her husband is her best friend.
We've reached one of the best parts of the Fireside series, the Q&A with the author and our dedicated audience. It's a chance to go beyond the book, connecting readers and writers on a deeper level. To make it easier for you, the listener, I've summarized the questions and we'll read them. The first question is about the stolen money. How did Harry Piper manage to secure $1 million, worth about $5.5 million in 2015, in $20 bills with such short notice?
You go to your friend George Dixon, who was then president of First National Bank in Minneapolis. This is an interesting aspect of the way things were done. This is 1972, so 4+ decades ago. All these guys knew each other. Bobby and George, and I mean, even the custom-made canvas bag, which was about the size of a duffel bag, came from Bemis Bag Company, an old line Minneapolis firm, and it was delivered by the president, George Young, who was also a buddy. And George Dixon got most of the money, most of the bills from the Federal Reserve in downtown Minneapolis. That was brought over. And then they were very carefully packaged. The instructions were intricate and very specific. And the money, the 50,000 unmarked $20 bills, were put in 4 packages. And those 4 packages were put in this duffel bag. And then that was transferred to the Piper home and then into the trunk of Bobby's car when he went off to deliver it the next night. Before he left George Dixon, George Dixon says, "Say, you know, maybe we better write something down, or maybe we should get something down on paper about this transaction." And again, very casual, these were all buddies. And so somebody produces a yellow legal pad, according to one story, and Bobby writes, "I, Harry Piper Jr., owe the First National Bank $1 million. Signed, Harry Piper Jr." And hands it to George. And that was good enough for George. And as it turned out, they did get their $1 million back. The Piper family, by various means within the family and within Bobby's company, uphold that $1 million sent it back to the Federal Reserve, or to First National. So that's what happened to that. Now, what happened to it after that is anybody's guess. The FBI recorded all 50,000 serial numbers. I have a booklet about this big and about 120 pages with every serial number in there. And that's how some few of those bills were discovered in various places, some banks in southern Minnesota, a retail outfit in the Twin Cities, and even in a drug deal in Philadelphia. I'm free to guess here, and I will. I'm sure that some of this money was laundered through the drug trade, which even in 1972 was robust.
The next question is about the elaborate instructions the kidnappers left for Harry Piper to follow. How are they delivered to the Piper household, and what did those instructions include?
They left an envelope in the house. Oh, this was very, very carefully planned. This was not the work of, I believe it was the work of amateurs, but some very intelligent and skillful amateurs. They left an envelope with the initial ransom demand in it. And it wasn't what you see on TV, you know, with these letters cut out of magazines and so on. It was typed, and when you read the book, I think you'll be impressed with this ransom note, because it left nothing to chance, nothing. And although there wasn't an overt threat in it, deliver this money by 9 o'clock tomorrow night or you won't see your wife again, there was none of that, not even a hint of that. It's very chilling and very ominous, in part because there isn't a threat. But the instructions are so precise, you know that one false step is going to be a problem. The instructions, the delivery instructions, were salted at four different places between the Piper's home in Orono and near downtown Minneapolis. There was even a tape recording. This was an amazing crime. There's no question about that, an amazing crime.
Next up, an audience member inquires about the FBI's role shortly after the kidnapping. Were agents tailing Harry Piper, waiting to apprehend the kidnappers?
No, the FBI adamantly wanted Bobby Piper either not to go, to have an FBI man go in his place and pretend to be Bobby, or pretend to be a Piper Jaffray employee, or hide in the trunk with a gun. You can imagine how that might have turned out. And Bobby, he said, no, I'm doing this by myself. He finally agreed to have a beeper. There were no GPS devices in those days. He had a beeper in the back seat of his car. And they even put a little camera behind the grill of his car. And not only that, despite their, you know, Bobby insisted on going alone without being tailed or any of that, despite his demand, the FBI took it upon themselves to put out something like 35 cars on the various probable routes. No one knew where he was going. No one knew where he was going at this point, exactly, beyond the initial spot. But they had all these cars out there, and they had three aircraft hovering above the western Hennepin County. But the kidnappers had thought of that as well. And so early on in his little stations of the cross, as it were, he was told to change cars. And so he changed cars. He transferred the $1 million from his car into this other car that was in this parking lot where they said it would be. And he continued his route in that car. And so nobody had any idea where he was, because nobody knew what he was driving at that point.
Following that question, an audience member asked about the last leg of Harry Piper's elaborate journey. Where was the money finally dropped off?
You probably won't be familiar with this place. It was called the Sportsman's Retreat, and it was a dive that's now under I-94, just west of downtown Minneapolis. Why that bar was chosen, needless to say, the FBI were all over it for several years after that, trying to figure out what the connection might be there. They never did, but that's where the money was transferred. The FBI fully expected to find Jenny Piper's body in the trunk of the car, by the way. That's why, you know, why they were insisting to Bobby that, I mean, they didn't say this, of course, you wouldn't say this to the husband, but they're thinking, You know, this is now a crime apprehension exercise. It's not a crime, it's not a victim rescue situation. They never rescue these victims, or very rarely anyway. He goes off with $1 million and they'll find her body in the trunk of a car someplace, and maybe his too, for that matter.
The next question is about the ramifications of the Piper kidnapping. Was the behavior of other wealthy families affected by the kidnapping, particularly around personal security?
Well, yes, and there was a fair amount of information out there. Families tend not to talk about, wealthy families tend not to talk about their security arrangements any more than the White House does. I mean, you just don't do that. But there was a rush on what was then kind of rudimentary security, electronic security devices. Many of these people, including the Pipers, had never locked their doors at night. They were out there in this wonderful isolation. These are huge lots, beautiful homes, much more opulent than the Pipers was, for that matter. Maybe they'd get a dog. The Pipers got a German Shepherd, ironically named Happy, after the abduction, and the dog was so surly that he attacked everybody, including family members, and FBI agents were afraid to get out of the car. They wouldn't get out of the car. So, you know, families did that, and a lot of families did that, and the Pipers probably did, you know, relatively little compared to the others, because Bobby was just not of a mind to, in his son's words, turn our home into a fortress. He just wasn't about that. He wasn't going to do that. But yes, everybody was, this was a hugely traumatic event that people talked about for years out there, probably still do. They do still, even when I'm not asking them about it.
Following that question, an audience member asked about how the FBI finally located Virginia Piper after Harry dropped off the money. Where was she finally discovered?
Well, as I said, I think an unidentified male contacted a clergyman in Minneapolis on Saturday morning by phone. She was kidnapped on Thursday afternoon. Bobby delivered the money on Friday evening. And Saturday morning, this Lutheran minister got a call from one of the kidnappers telling him where she was and telling him to tell the FBI. The FBI then flew to Duluth and found her in the woods and brought her home.
Next up, an audience member asked Swanson to provide more information about Callahan and Larson, the two suspects arrested for the kidnapping but eventually acquitted by a jury for the crime.
Yes, they were tried together and they were acquitted together. It's one of those things, the jury didn't talk afterward. So we don't know exactly what was on their mind, but they deliberated, as I said, for only 3 hours, which this trial went on, both trials went on for 2 or 3 months, and hundreds of witnesses and testimony and relatively little forensic evidence, and what there was highly botched, I think. But there was also the question of jurisdiction, and this is important, and it's a small technicality, but in order for this case to be tried in federal court as a federal crime, the state statute of limitations had expired after 3 years. The federal, after 5 years, but with, you know, as I said, a couple weeks before it expired, they arrested Callahan and Larson and indicted them. But they still, in order to be tried in federal court, you had to have interstate motion. She had to be taken across a state line. Well, between the Twin Cities and Jay Cook, there is about 1,000 feet, a very, very short stretch of highway that's actually in Wisconsin, Highway 23. You don't even know you're in Wisconsin. But you are. And the FBI and the prosecution insisted that they had, in fact, with Ginny in the car, crossed into Wisconsin, thereby making it a federal case. But the and the, you know, that was, you either believe that or not. And Meshbesher's people, their researchers produced a map that showed there are, you know, there are 9 ways into Jay Cook from the Twin Cities. And if you believe that the FBI, that the kidnappers took that Wisconsin route, or if you don't believe that, I should say, then you had no case. Then everything else was moot. So there's speculation among the lawyers anyway that the jurors decided that early on and then said, well, there's no point talking about the rest of it. This case shouldn't have been tried in federal court.
In the second to last question, an audience member asked how the FBI identified Callahan and Larson as prime suspects in the kidnapping.
Well, these guys, as I say, were career criminals. They had been in and out of, they were middle-aged guys. They were in their 40s. They had been in and out of jail for minor crimes since they were teenagers. You know, car theft and the occasional stick-up. But, you know, these were not the, Callahan was a reasonably smart guy. He was a cabinet maker by legitimate trade. Larson, by all accounts, was a dummy. But even Callahan, it's hard to believe that Callahan, on his best day, could create a plan like this, and develop these written orders, because they really are extraordinary. I mean, it's not Shakespeare. It's not the work of a literary writer, but it's just somebody who's really smart and knows how to plan each point along the way. To me and to many people, it's just inconceivable that these two guys may have helped out in some way, but they certainly weren't the ringleaders behind this.
Finally, an audience member draws parallels between the 1963 murder of Carol Thompson, the subject of Swanson's earlier book, Dial M, and the Piper kidnapping. How were the two cases similar in terms of how they impacted the community's overall consciousness?
Well, it did, and the fact that people are still always coming up to me and talking about the Thompson case, it might have been an even greater impact simply because it was so shocking. This was a shocking crime, but Ginny Piper did physically survive it, you know, and Carol Thompson did not. And the fact that her husband was ultimately convicted of planning and bankrolling the crime in this Ozzie and Harriet type environment that existed in 1963, at least in our imaginations. Well, I think that's it. I think they're going to turn on the sprinklers here.
You've been listening to the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. The next episode will feature Minnesota Book Award finalist and author Jim Lenfesti and poet Wang Ping, with a musical accompaniment by Master Zhang Ying and violinist Nicholas Whitridge. Until then, we hope you consider supporting the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library and its mission, stronger libraries for stronger communities. Learn more at thefriends.org. Follow us on Twitter at The Friends and on Facebook at facebook.com/friendsofsppl. Please consider subscribing to this podcast on iTunes.